I want to take the three major arguments that Michael Martin uses against theism and show you how a presuppositional approach to apologetics can deal with them. The three arguments are about the factual meaninglessness of theism. Christian theism is what I'll be talking about. Secondly, the logical incoherence of our concept of God. And thirdly, the problem of evil. And I'm thinking, as a teaching strategy, maybe the best thing would be for me not to open the book and just talk off the top of my head and give you a thumbnail sketch of what's going on in all three, and then with the time that's left, I'll go back and try to fill in some detail. Okay? So this may not be as detailed, you know, line by line, scripture and verse sort of thing as we've been doing, but at least I'll be able to cover the ground. The first argument, and as it turns out, the crux argument for Michael Martin, is that theism is not factually meaningful, that its claims are vacuous of factual meaning. There are different kinds of meaning that he's willing to grant. There may be emotive meaning, there may be commitment of lifestyle, there may be those sorts of things. But meaning in terms of stating any fact is not there in terms of theism. Now, I say this is a crux argument because he over and over again in his book says that he thinks he's shown that Christianity, well, I'm just going to say Christianity because I'm a Christian, but theism is meaningless. And if it's meaningless, he says atheism is meaningless too. At least he's good enough to recognize that. Now, he says positive atheism is meaningless, but not negative atheism. Negative atheism, remember, is we have grounds for not believing. And in this case, if Christianity or theism is meaningless, there's a reason for not believing in it. But to say that the claim God exists means something and is false is also refuted by chapter 2, the discussion of the meaningfulness of religious discourse, if it shows what Michael Martin thinks it shows. And yet, there's a whole lot more to this book than chapter 2. And so he has to explain over and over again why he's going into this, you know. He gets to the end of the first major section on negative atheism, and then he says, well, we really don't need to go any further than this, but let me explain to you why I'm going to. My first criticism of him is, if he's to be taken seriously, he should not have written the whole book. Now, I realize the defense he offers is, well, maybe I'm wrong, in which case I need some backup arguments. There's two problems with that defense. One, he doesn't say, maybe I'm wrong, all the time. Often in the book, he says, it's been established that. We've seen that, on and on and on. We've made a good case that. In fact, he can even tell us, inductively, that it's highly improbable that anybody will or can answer what he's brought about. So, I mean, what you get here is kind of a mixture of arrogance and humility. It's like, I've shown that it can't be proven, but on the other hand, just in case I'm wrong. That's what's disingenuous about that rationale. But secondly, if he does believe that God talk is meaningless, then everything he's doing in the rest of his book is meaningless too, even when he has fallback arguments in case he's wrong. And so apparently, God talk is not meaningless, is it? Anybody who can write a book referring to God that many times in an attempt to disconfirm it must think that at least it's possible that there's meaning here. So he has not showed the meaninglessness of God talk. So that's my first criticism, is you can't have it both ways. Chapter 2 should have done it, but it didn't. Now, in chapter 2, he presents different versions of the claim that religious talk is meaningless. And he does recognize, and he's obviously done reading in this area. He has some detailed background, bibliography, and so forth, he knows that what we call strong versions of the verifiability criterion have been very easily refuted. The strong versions have. A strong version of the verifiability criterion says that a statement is meaningful only if, in principle, you could decisively confirm it or disconfirm it. It's not as though all the writers put the word decisive in there, but that's how that's to be interpreted. That's the way they treat it. And then counterexamples are given, which easily show that that either is too restrictive or too open a criterion for meaningfulness. If the goal was to get rid of religion and ethics and hold on to the language of science, you lose the language of science on that criterion also. Or if it does allow for that, it also allows for any statement whatsoever, including meaningless statements, to pass the criterion if you're clever enough to use the mechanism. Okay, so Michael Martin's aware of that. This has had a checkered history, to put it politely. And what has happened in the development of 20th century linguistic and analytical study is that people moved away from the verifiability criterion to a falsifiability criterion for meaningfulness. Karl Popper, most famous name, but a number of others with him. But then it turned out that the falsifiability criterion has difficulties too. From a Christian standpoint, we would say, for you to claim that a statement is meaningful only if in principle it can be falsified, what you were saying essentially is that all committal talk is meaningless. But it's not just religious people who speak with commitment about their views. Now what if I were to say Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated President Kennedy with the help of his wife? And what if, for some reason, that's a real precious thesis to me, maybe a lot of pride's tied up in it, or maybe there's some political motive, but whatever it is, I'm strongly going to defend that. And let's say you bring me counter evidence after counter evidence, and every time you bring me counter evidence, I've got an explanation, I've got an explanation, I've got an explanation. Well, after a while, you might say, as Anthony Flew does in his famous article about the meaninglessness of God talk, you might say, well, this thesis has died the death of 1,000 qualifications. It's not open to falsification. Now, let me ask you this. If I treat that thesis as not open to falsification because I have to have an answer for everything, you would say, I'm really committed to that thesis, wouldn't you? But would you say that what I had claimed is meaningless? Of course not. We all know what it means to say Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK with the help of his wife. That's not a meaningless sentence. By the way, that sentence passes Michael Martin's test too, because he says any sentence that's meaningful has got to have, to put it crudely, some empirical operator. It's got to be, you got to be able to touch it empirically, confirm it, disconfirm it, but it's got to make a difference empirically. Well, my sentence does, but I treat it as falsifiable. The mistake that Anthony Flew made is that he confused a logical characteristic with a psychological characteristic. It is true, even as a Christian, I would admit this, it is true that if a sentence you have is logically compatible with every other sentence, it's a meaningless sentence. Logically. That is, if that sentence conjoined with any other sentence which is true makes the compound true, then that sentence is not, that first part of the compound is not saying anything. But you see, that kind of non-falsifiability, that is, you can never assign false to it as a logical value, has nothing to do with the psychological way in which people treat that sentence. And so Flew looks at Christians treating sentences in a non-falsifiable way, and then he says, as though it was logically meaningless. And that's just a huge mistake. And I have an article on that if you want to pursue it further. That's what I was going to go over in my lecture that I never got to. So this has a checkered history. Do atheists have their non-falsifiable commitments? Sure they do. We've seen an example of that for 2 days, almost three now. John Frame wrote a wonderful parody of Anthony Flew's Parable of the Gardener, in which he has a man who says, there's a gardener who comes here, and he offers all this really great evidence, takes the skeptic to the gardener's house, shows him around, all those sorts of things. But for everything that he shows him, the skeptic's got an explanation, not this, not that. And Frame, following the parody, says, what has happened to this fine, brash hypothesis that there is no gardener? It's died the death of a thousand qualifications. Now, all this proves, and this is the way Frame sees it, but others have done the same thing, all this proves is that the things that we're strongly committed to resist falsification. It doesn't prove that they're meaningless. And so when someone says Christianity is meaningless because Christians treat their statements as presuppositions, that's no defect. We shouldn't be, you know, bothered by that at all. And all we have to say is yes, and you've got your non-falsifiable statements as well. Now, Michael Martin pushes a bit beyond this history of the problem, and he wants to argue that it's not just that Christians treat their statements as falsifiable that makes them meaningless. He rests upon the work of Kai Nielsen, remember, and on the basis of Nielsen's work gives us a verifiability criterion, which I'm trying to find quickly here for you. Well, essentially, it's that a sentence is meaningful only if there is some conceivable evidence that would count for it or against it. Some conceivable empirical evidence that would count for it or against it. P1, for any statement S is factually meaningful if and only if there's at least some observational statement O that could count for or against S. And I put here in my margin, so the debate comes down to how we decide whether something counts for or against another statement or not. What is it to count for or not to count for? And that's what the debate's going to be all about. Also on this page, I note that you get two different versions here. One version says you have to have conceivable evidence that would count for it and conceivable evidence that would count against it. And another version says, a weaker one, as long as you have one or the other, then it's factually meaningful. So we're not really sure what's being tested here. On the top of page 51, Nielsen is, he says, if, quote, God governs the world, end of quote, did have such significance, it would have to have a different empirical content than does it is not the case that God governs the world or God does not govern the world. He says, but this is not the case. Well, that's just absolutely false to say. There is a different significance. When someone says God governs the world and someone denies that God governs the world, they do things differently which are empirically checkable. A real obvious example. If I believe God governs the world and there's been a tragedy in my congregation, I might go into my bedroom and pray. But somebody who doesn't say that God governs the world would not go into his bedroom and pray. So it does make a difference. But is it a confirmable difference? Because somebody might say, well, I don't even believe in God, and I might go into my bedroom and pray. So what you're doing doesn't confirm the meaningfulness of it. Well, but again, I don't have to confirm the meaningfulness of it. All I have to show is that it makes a difference whether you believe this or not. And then at the end of this quote, Nielsen uses the expression, that the non-believer might very well accept the believer's claim about this, that, and the other, and still not see how this gives us grounds for believing in God. It's that still not see. That is, not wish to see how it gives us grounds for believing in God. That's the whole rub of the issue here, it seems to me, is what counts for and doesn't count for. And your worldview determines that. So when somebody who doesn't want to be convinced says, I don't let that count for, he doesn't wish to see that as an evidence relationship. And that's all we're learning here. And Wittgenstein, Hume, Plantinga, Van Til, and others have taught that to us. Sometimes you have very meaningful things that people refuse to be willing to see. They won't take that as evidence for something else. And I put down, here's the whole issue. The empirical facts of concern for love, justice, etc. are not part of the meaning of the atheist claim about the world. Transcendentally, when an atheist says, oh, I can grant that there's love, I can grant that there's justice and so forth, but that has nothing to do with confirming theism or disconfirming it, I say, yes, it does, because the atheist claim that there is no God cannot accommodate the statement there is love. Why is that? On the atheist worldview, love doesn't have an empirical meaning. Now, what if someone tried to give an empirical meaning? By love, I mean pats his dog on his head, kisses his wife, gives toys to his children. Well, you know there can be real problems, right? What if this means pats his children on the head, kisses his dog? No, it doesn't mean that. You've got to know how to use love in the different settings, too. Okay? But now, in every one of those cases, a person could kiss his wife, pat his dog on the head, or give toys to his children and hate them. So that isn't the meaning, just the outward symptom, is it? Now, how can the atheist, the materialist, give us empirically verifiable, or at least in a weak sense, confirmable, disconfirmable meaning to love, or justice, or what have you? So to the extent that we use that language, we've got evidence for theism and against atheism. Moreover, earlier today, I gave you all a statement, which I don't think anybody will dismiss as meaningless, that I said is just one of thousands of statements I could give you that are evidence that Christianity's true. What was the statement? There's a flower growing in my garden. That seems pretty simple, doesn't it? Everybody would admit that that's got some empirical meaning. It's confirmable, disconfirmable. And my argument is that sentence is evidence of God's existence, as is the sentence, the lawn is growing, I have children that eat cookies, and on and on and on. So if that's all we have to do is produce a sentence that has some empirical content to show that God talk is meaningful, that's not hard to do at all. And this is my thumbnail sketch of how to refute Michael Martin. I have an awful lot of cross-examination of the way he carries on this argument. It's also in this section, let me remind you, that he finally defends his approach to the meaningfulness of things by an appeal to intuition. This matches our intuitions. Well, he's given me everything I need then. I can say, well, but my approach matches my intuitions. I really wish I could tell you how it kills me not to be able to tell you all this good stuff. I'll just have to have another seminar and finish doing what I wanted to do in detail. The second major argument against Christianity or theism is the incoherence in the concept of God. And here he says you cannot define the attributes of God in a way which is coherent. To take the opening illustration, chapter 12, he says that God's omniscience cannot be defined in a way that leaves us with the traditional view of God and coherence as well. He also shows us how we're going to escape all of his attempts, right in the middle of page 286. He says, it's difficult to get a person to accept that a proposition entails a contradiction if the proposition is God exists, since that person will do so only if that person accepts some controversial analyses of the attributes of God. But that person might refuse to accept such analyses. Okay, now we're done with chapter 12, and we can move on to the problem of evil. I mean, I'm going to explain this. But do you realize, and that's exactly right, because all he does in this chapter, and it's tedious the way he does it, is he goes through and he offers this definition, says this is the problem, this definition, this is a problem, and therefore he says you've got incoherence. And I said, well, I've got incoherence in my view only if I accept your definition of these attributes. But I don't accept your definitions of these attributes, so there's no problem. Now, there's more to be said, of course, because he's going to say, well, then you'd better give me a definition of these attributes. And I already indicated to you yesterday, the amazing thing to me about that claim is that it's child's work to do that. It's not hard at all. I can explain in just a second why scholars and philosophers have made it hard, but it's not hard at all. The reason why it's not hard is, first of all, we've got long-standing definitions of these attributes in the Christian tradition that have held up against the kind of counterexamples and so forth that he brings up. And so in the Westminster Confession, for instance, you can read what it says about the omniscience of God, and it doesn't strike you as creating these contradictions at all. However, a person could say, the Puritans didn't anticipate all of these different difficulties that philosophers could bring up. And I can answer that by saying, yes, and look at the nature of the difficulties that they try to bring up. It comes down to this sort of thing. You're gonna see Michael Martin say, omniscience eventually is going to have to be defined as God having all factual knowledge. By the way, I'm not too upset about that, because that's what I think has traditionally been meant by the omniscience of God. The other understandings of knowledge, where you have, for instance, knowledge as a skill, to know something is to know how to do something, to have a skill. Well, you can still recast the omniscience of God in terms of having all know-how. And then his counterexample, you remember, says, yeah, but God doesn't know how to use the parallel bars in gymnastics. To which I say, yes, he does. He has all know-how. As long as you break know-how down into information about the workings of cause-effect possibilities, strategy, and sequencing, and add to that the power to achieve what you wish to with that information, and coordination. Now, the only problem is God's disembodied, so you can say, how is he coordinated? And that's explained as a hypothetical attribute. And God, with all this information and all this power, were he to take on a body, could do all these feats in gymnastics. I'm telling you, it's child's work to do this. But on the other hand, I'm not real proud of myself for being able to do that, because I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm taking what is in my linguistic community a common understanding of an attribute of God. I've already said Christians usually mean by that God has all factual knowledge. That's no problem. And then I look at the complication a philosopher offers, and what I do is I build back into my definition the answer to that difficulty. So I can give you an analysis of omniscience. I haven't bothered to write it out because you can see how complicated it gets. I don't think all that's necessary. I can give you an analysis of the omniscience of God, and I can handle every one of the counterexamples that he brings up. And all I have to do is now string all that together with ands, and say, okay, that's my concept of omniscience. Now, he may not like that procedure, but he has no reason, you know, to discount it. All he's asking for is a description. Now, here's where the complications come in. Philosophers love to do this. If I say God has all factual knowledge is expressed in propositions, right? A proposition can be something like, I know that the cat is in the tree. Now, that proposition, if God has all factual knowledge, does God know that proposition too? And what that creates, and this is, to me, it is trivial. It creates the difficulty that God could only know that if he's the I in the sentence, I know that the cat is in the tree. Okay, so now you take these philosophers, they think they're so cute. What you do is you deal with that problem and you build it back in recursively into your explanation of omniscience. Omniscience is God has all factual knowledge where the expression of the fact does not include an indexical. Oh, but then there are other problems. Okay, he raises that one. You can see that there may be a way around that and so forth. What are some of the other problems? Oh, you can, this is the funniest one of all, and he does it over and over again through all these pages. He'll say, what if you describe a situation this way? A non-omniscient being brings it about that a spoon falls off the table, something like that. Oh, that's in the power aspect. Well, we'll jump ahead. I'll use that as an illustration. Now, can God do that? Can God bring it about that a non-omniscient being has a spoon fall off the table? Well, God doesn't have the power to do that, because if he did it, then he wouldn't be omniscient. How do you answer these problems? Now, back on the knowing side of things, let me see if I can find the complication the way he puts it. Well, he uses the example of negative, unrestricted existential statements. Probably all enjoyed that, right, if you haven't been reading in philosophy.
What about that one about the impossibility of there being a set of all truths? Something fishy there, I just didn't know.
Oh, yeah, there's something real fishy. Let me finish what I'm saying, and then I'm going to get to that. The problem is, the way you describe what God knows, if you're clever enough, you can put it in the passive voice and say that he knows some, or you can say what God does is described in such a way that it's brought about by such and such a being. Now, can God do that? The answer is no, because he's not that kind of being. But you can define what God knows so that it's free of those complications. Propositions cannot include indexicals and these sorts of things. Nor can you describe the things God can do in such a way that it automatically excludes God doing it. Martin has problems with that, though, because he says, well, then you've trivialized your definition. You know the examples of McNose and McEar that he likes to use? He says, well, if you put it that way, and what you're saying is God can do everything that God can do, so now if I have a being, McNose, which can only scratch his nose, this is what makes people hate philosophers and say, yeah, what kind of being is that? But okay, hypothetically. And then what you do is, he can do everything except which is described in a way that excludes him doing it. Now, he's omnipotent. But you see, you can describe the omnipotence of God and the omniscience of God in terms of what God knows and what God does in such a way that it's the sort of thing anybody else could do, and even more, or you can do all things which are logically possible, provided they don't conflict with God's moral nature. And you've escaped the problem. The only thing that's left, and I wish I could find an efficient way of telling you this, the only thing that's left here is just really cleaning up the plate. And so philosophers come along and say, well, what about when you put it this way? And you say, okay, well, then we can't put it that way. And you find an alternative description. Does this mean, I think that those descriptions are available, but does it mean, if you cannot give such a description, that the attribute that you're using is incoherent? No, because people can have a rough and ready idea of how to use a concept, even though they could not give you a necessary and sufficient condition of how to define it. People can describe things and use concepts and do so coherently, even though they're not able to give a recursive or if and only if definition of its meaning. So what we have here is basically a linguistic game. But let's look at the set of all truths. People will point out, if you mean by omniscience, God knows the set of all truths, and there is no set of all truths, then God's not omniscient. Well, there's a couple ways of dealing with that. One, then that's not my definition of God's omniscience. So in other words, he gives me a definition that has built into it a time bomb. And then he lets the time bomb go off. And he says, aha, see, you've got a problem. I said, well, no, I reject. If the concept, the set of all truths, has a philosophical problem, then I don't choose to use that to define the omniscience of God. Well, how else are you going to define the omniscience of God? So I say, well, I don't have to use the notion of sets at all. Here's a definition of the omniscience of God that doesn't make use of set theory whatsoever. Now I'm quoting from the Westminster Confession of Faith. In his sight, all things are open and manifest. His knowledge is infinite, infallible, and independent upon the creature, so as nothing to him is contingent or uncertain. Notice I didn't refer to the set of all truths there. There's no limit in the sense that it's infinite, and what God knows is never contingent. It's never, you know, shaky kind of stuff. He knows everything certainly. And I can work with that, and I can deal with the problems he thinks he brings up. But now, going back to the set of all truths, the reason why the set of all truths isn't possible is because what you have is subsets of sets. And if you say that anything about a subset of a set is a truth, it turns out you can have an infinite regress of subsets of the set. And so it turns out, and this is the paradox, you know, and it's clever, I enjoy it. I don't think it's really very profound when all is said and done. Here's the paradox. The set of all truths, what's the number in there? Well, whatever it is, it's a growing number. Because the set of all truths also has a subset within the set of all truths. And that's a truth, so whatever the first number is, it's now that number plus one. But we can keep doing this, and so what do you want to say here? The set of all sets is infinite. And the only person that can know an infinite set is God. Oh, all of a sudden the problem's gone. Or you could say the set of all sets includes itself. This is one way to deal with self-reference paradoxes in philosophy. I'm not sure that's the best way of doing it, but if the set of all sets includes itself, then you can't dismiss it as incoherent. Or, this is the answer I like the best. Since God knows everything, he knows the solution to paradoxes of self-reference, too. So I don't know what to tell you about the set of all truths, but because God knows everything, he does. You see, by definition, this is, again, I'm just working out my presuppositions. Since I believe God knows all things, and I know how to use that, all the challenges can be answered. If nothing else, I can say, well, God knows everything. He knows how to resolve these set reference problems, too. Yeah, it's similar. You know Bertrand Russell's paradox, this sentence is false. Can you interpret that? Well, it turns out you cannot interpret it if you don't go to a higher level, an iterated level. Okay, so you've got to have two languages, really, in order to even talk about that. And so these set reference paradoxes may be the same sort of thing. And that's why I say it's fascinating if you have a logical, mathematical mind, but it's not a challenge to theological notions at all. Everybody's got that problem. And so if you say, God knows everything, what do you do with this set? I can say, I'm not smart enough to resolve that, but whatever the resolution is, that's what God would have said about it. And now the problem's gone. I do not. He seems to act like this chapter is really powerful stuff, and I just see this chapter is diddling. You know, it's not that difficult at all to deal with these problems. Let me jump ahead to the third illustration: the omnipotence of God. I like to talk about this one because this is what Gordon Stein was trying to push on me when we were corresponding with each other. He said, you can't talk about God because your theology is inherently incoherent. And he gave us his example, you know, this paradox about omnipotence. And he said, God's supposed to be able to do everything, but on your view, he can't do everything, so he's not omnipotent. Now, what can I say about that? And I can say, my definition of omnipotence is not the ability to do everything. And when I did that, he got really upset. He said, now you're just playing around. That isn't what Christians have meant by omnipotence. I've said, God's able to do all his holy will, which is one of our catechism answers, by the way, we teach our children. But God can do everything that's consistent with his will. And he said, that qualification's not fair. That's not what we mean by omnipotence. I said, in my tradition, theologically, it's what it means. And then he made a real mistake here. He said, no theologian has ever said that. So I pulled down a few books, you know, Burkhoff, Hodge, Dabney, as I recall, and I just quoted them. I said, here, that qualification's built in, and they didn't know you and I were going to have this argument, so you don't, you know, you can't say, well, they just went back and put it in there. I said, that has always been the way omnipotence has been explained to me, and well, it should. We don't have time to look them up. Briefly, put in your notes, though, 2 Timothy 2:13. 2 Timothy 2:13 says, God cannot deny himself. A specific example would be Hebrews 6:18. The Bible says, it is impossible for God to lie. Well, now, if I'm trying to summarize the Christian concept of God, and my approach to doing theology is, I've got to go look at all these sentences in the Bible, boil them down, combine them, whatever your vision of how you do theology is. The point is, I'm responsible to express these sentences. And these sentences tell me there are certain things God cannot do. Well, then my definition of almighty or omnipotent is going to have to accord with sentences that say God can't do certain things. That's not a problem whatsoever. What would be a problem is if I let a pagan define a concept that uses philosophical terms like all or knowledge and so forth, and then have him try to pin that on me as what I must mean when I use the language of omnipotence and omniscience. Well, I'm a better Wittgensteinian than that. I'm not going to let his language game dictate to my language game. And where did I learn my language game? In the context of Christian worship, reading the Bible, and so forth. And there's no problem. Somebody says, well, there does appear to be a problem in what the Bible says. We have linguistic conventions for explaining the apparent contradictions and things like that. But I don't have to accept, even as an apparent contradiction, somebody else's definition. That's why I'm saying he gave me at the very beginning the answer to all of his problems when he says, well, I can just say I don't accept your analysis. What I put in my margin, one of the many things I put, is this chapter is a fine lesson in how not to do theology. How should we do theology? Well, I note here, Christians are not bound to one extra-biblical summary words. The word omniscience doesn't appear in the Bible, for instance. So if somebody were to say, you can't explain omniscience in its ordinary sense, you know, and maintain coherence, I can say, fine, get rid of omniscience then. I don't need that word. But if I'm going to use it to any and all linguistic habits pertaining to such words or their components, how can I put this? We're not bound to any and all linguistic habits pertaining to those words. So if there are people who have used omniscience or omnipotence in a way that's subject to his criticism, I can say, well, those are not my linguistic habits with respect to that word. Okay, well then, what are my linguistic habits? Christians define God's attributes, and sometimes they use extra-biblical terms, in a summary way, like the word Trinity. Christians define extra-biblical terms, and they sometimes let the term be a summary term, meaning not all qualifications are found in that term. But sometimes we do that. And when we do it according to biblical information and exemplars, which are contextualized by everything in the Bible. Let me say it again. Christians define God's attributes, even when we use extra-biblical terms, according to biblical information and exemplars, which are contextualized by everything in the Bible. So when I use a summary word, that doesn't mention all the qualifications. My approach to theology says that word must be used implicitly with the qualifications of the Bible built in, even if I don't mention them all. But that's the way I understand the concept. So now I read in the Bible that God, with God, all things are possible. Somebody says, oh, does that mean that God can do logically impossible things? I say, no, that isn't the way the Bible uses the expression, with God all things are possible. God can't contradict himself. God can't lie, so no, he can't do logically impossible things. You see, I didn't use philosophical terms, I just used biblical terms. But when somebody gives me a philosophical problem, all I have to do is I say, well, but the Bible shows how I can deal with that. Here's the famous conundrum. Can God make a stone so heavy that God cannot lift it? And I've watched Christians try to answer that in all these different ways. The answer is just a straightforward no. Well, then God can't do everything. I said, so what? The Bible doesn't say God can do everything. It tells us he cannot deny himself. And if God made a stone too heavy for him to lift, he'd no longer be God. So he'd be denying himself. So what I'm getting at is, within Christian theology, we have linguistic habits, a speaking community, that can define the concept and do it in a coherent way. And then when philosophers bring up their problems, all we have to say is, well, this is, here's how you deal with that, here's how you deal with this. And one of the moves that we have available to us here is always to say, well, then I won't speak about the set of all truths. The Bible doesn't require me to talk that way. And I'm not saying I can only talk the way the Bible does, but on the other hand, the only thing you can pin on me is what the Bible tells me to say. And so chapter 12 of this book, for all of its, you know, the forcefulness of its presentation, is really, it comes down to, how do you do theology? And if you do it the way I've described, we don't have these paradoxes. We don't have these problems. Okay, the last major problem that he deals with, and this is the biggest portion of the book, and so it's all the more scandalous that I can't go line by line with you, but it's the problem from evil. And I would think, if you're not familiar with the debates recently, you might be surprised that what is usually called the problem of evil is brought up and dismissed by Michael Martin in three quarters of a page. Page 335. Most people will tell you, here's the problem of evil. If a Christian says God is all good and God is all powerful, some versions say, and God knows everything, and yet evil exists, then it's inconsistent. There's an internal contradiction within Christianity, or, well, I'm going to make it Christianity, but within theism. There's an internal contradiction, because if God knows all things, he knows how to prevent evil. If God can do all things, God has the ability to do what he knows to prevent evil. And if God is all good, then he wouldn't want evil. Therefore, if there's evil, you've got to either give up God's omniscience, his power, or his goodness. Now, that's the way it's usually presented. In fact, I can tell you over and over again, in colleges, philosophy and religion courses, introduction to philosophy courses, you'll have professors who will put that kind of thing up on the board, and they'll leave it right at that and leave these religious, you know, poor, silly students out there to twist, you know, under this, and they say, there's no relief to this. Well, most people who are familiar with this field, and I have to give Martin credit, at least he's done his reading, realize that that's not difficult to resolve at all. You can show there's no paradox if you just add another proposition. That's always the strategy for resolving paradox. And the proposition you add is, whatever evil exists is a morally sufficient reason. That's not the same as saying it's not really evil. It is really evil, but the real evil that exists has a morally sufficient reason. For instance, years ago, my second son fell off a kitchen stool, and he gashed his nose, and it was a very nasty accident, and he was bleeding profusely. We ran him to the emergency room, And because they had to take care of this right away, they didn't really have time to properly use the Novocaine. They had to get some stitch in there to stop the bleeding. That's one of the toughest things in my whole life, to hold David's hand when he's screaming in pain. I also knew that I was saving his life. Now, was it painful just because it was saving his life? You betcha. But there was a morally sufficient reason to inflict that pain on him. Now, he was really young. I do think he probably knew that you couldn't get away from this somehow. You're in the hospital, the doctors are working. But you know, it's not inconceivable that he might be lying on the table saying, my father is inflicting unnecessary pain on me, and it really, really is intense. But I know from outside the situation that I had a good reason to do that. And the doctors had a good reason to do what I was paying them to do. Sometimes I present this to people by saying, did you know one day I paid people to inflict pain on my son? What? I said, oh yeah. And it was intense pain too. Now, if that's all you know of the situation, that certainly looks evil, doesn't it? And then I say, and by the way, he was bleeding to death, and so that's why the doctors did it, and I paid them for their services. Now all of a sudden I've added a proposition or information that takes away all the difficulty. So we do know that you can sometimes have a morally sufficient reason for the evil, in this case the pain, that exists. Now all the Christian has to say is, whatever evil exists, God has a morally sufficient reason for it. And so Michael Martin is good enough to realize that that takes care of the problem. In the middle of page 335 he says, however, this approach has generally been regarded as unsuccessful. I wish everybody was so kind. You know, I have to explain this over and over again to people. He says, he adds this proposition, 2', God would prevent evil unless God had a morally sufficient reason to allow it. Well, since the deductive argument against God is easily answered, you would think that should end it. And now we're going to go page by page by page. Why? Because once I say there's a morally sufficient reason for evil, he's going to challenge me. He's going to say, what is that morally sufficient reason? I cannot do justice to all this. It boils down to this. The answers that will work, and many don't. By the way, his attack on John Hick is absolutely right. Not everything he says is right, but when he gets that, when John Hick says God must create a world that would be what you'd expect if you were an atheist in order to truly develop faith and moral virtue and so forth, I'm saying this is so bizarre. It's a shame to see, well, I don't really think Hick is a professing Christian anymore, but he wasn't an evangelical ever. But nevertheless, a man in the name of Christianity resorts to that kind of defense. What does Paul say in Romans 1? God has constructed the world in such a way that no one can avoid knowing him. Hick says, well, maybe I can answer the problem of evil if we say God created the world in such a way as you're most inclined not to believe in him. And then you've got to overcome that. So when Michael Martin does an internal critique of something like that, I'm cheering him on. Not because I'm with him philosophically and I like him personally and all the way, but Hick deserves to be brought down. He deserves to be refuted, and Martin's done a pretty good case of that. But let's go back to the general. And by the way, I also agree that he's dealt with Alvin Plantinga fairly effectively. Although I could go to the heart of Plantinga's problem faster. Can I name that tune in a minute and a half? Here's the problem with Plantinga. Plantinga's free will defense assumes that God could not create a situation where men have free will and never do evil. Those of you who've done the reading, you know what I'm talking about? He will not accept that definition, or that definition is that is not a possibility given his definition of freedom. Well, Alvin Plantinga's difficulty is he's got the Bible against him. Because the Bible says there is going to be a situation where people are free and they never do evil. That day is yet to come. We all long for it, don't we? when we will not become automatons, but we will be so perfected in righteousness that we freely and always do the right thing. That's going to be grand. There's no conceptual problem with that. But Alvin Plantinga doesn't accept that. Now, Martin's got to go a long way around the barn to say, well, but that is a possibility, so why didn't God choose to create a world where men freely did what was good? Or alternatively, why didn't he create a world where the evil that men attempt to do is always counteracted by whatever natural laws are there? And I don't think Plantinga has an answer to that. The free will defense is not a defense. Provided you say men could be free and never do evil, then the question is, well, then why didn't God ordain that from the beginning? And I'm not going to, you know, hide my humility about this sort of thing. I don't know. I also don't need to know, because I trust that he does all things well. Somebody might say it was evil of God not to create that world at the outset rather than to make that the end product of history. And I say, yeah, but you see, on my theology, by definition, whatever God does is good. He's the exemplar of righteousness and justice. And so, no, it can't be that God did something that is evil.
Isn't that a basic problem with his premises, though? I mean, when he uses the word good or knowledge, just like he discussed a few minutes ago, he doesn't mean what we mean.
Boy, I tell you, I'm almost willing to end the class on that. That's a glorious observation. When it all comes down to it, what you have here is Christianity and its worldview is internally defined, and our reasoning is internally governed. We don't reason. There's an independent standard of good by which I can judge God. That's ruled out if you're a consistent Christian. And that bothers Michael Martin. What he is constantly trying to do, whether you define the attributes of God, or define goodness, or define freedom, he's always trying to go outside the Christian worldview from which he can get a pousteau to criticize the Christian worldview. But it doesn't work that way. His worldview doesn't work that way. He doesn't use our definitions when he's operating his worldview. And so now people think, well, Dr. Bonson, you're saying you can't talk to each other, you can't argue with each other? I said, no. And you know the answer already. He's made in the image of God, I'm made in the image of God, we both live in God's world, and so he's inconsistent with his worldview. He shouldn't do inductive reasoning at all, but he does. And because he does, I can say, as he's acting, quote-unquote, in a quasi-godly way, using inductive reasoning, I can say, oh, I see that you're on your way to the Christian worldview, you're acting like we would. Oh, no. And I say, oh, no? Well, then give me an account of induction on your worldview. So when I say that, following up your observation, our terms and our reasoning are internally defined and rule-governed, and his are as well, that doesn't commit me to incommensurability, and it doesn't commit me to relativism and so forth. But it does give me what is, this is now the general answer to almost every problem he'll bring up. He says, but you're not following Christian presuppositions in this argument. And that's why they never work. Whenever you try to define the omnipotence of God, I'm going to come back and say, but the Bible tells me. And it's the Bible that gives me my concept of God. And then Gordon Stein wrote to me and he said, but that's not what omnipotence means. It means he can do everything. To which I can say, well, it may mean that to some people, but it doesn't mean that to me. Worldviews in collision, we got here. The problem of evil comes down to this. He says, all right, it's not a deductive problem, because you can always say God has a morally sufficient reason. But he can say it's an inductive problem, because it's not likely that God has a morally sufficient reason. And why isn't it likely? Because you haven't given me the morally sufficient reason. Now, what happens when somebody says, but theoretically, maybe we can't understand the morally sufficient reason, or God chooses not to give it to us? And then he flails around with that for a while, but eventually he concedes something that you've got to get in your notes. He concedes, we're in the vicinity of pages 336 and following. And look at 338 in particular. We're dealing with a view that says, and I'm picking up in the second paragraph, But although God may indeed grasp goods beyond our ken, oh no, the view is that God may grasp goods that are beyond our ken, and they have not yet occurred. And so now Michael Martin, to escape that problem, has got to find, you know, a way of dealing with that. The next paragraph, dealing with Rao again. He admits that on some versions of what he calls expanded theism, the likelihood of ungraspable goods would follow. And that would be a worldview that's conjoined with other religious claims about sin, a future life, a last judgment, etc. And then he says, Orthodox Christianity is a version of expanded theism. Well, this is getting interesting because he's getting real close to saying, well, maybe there's a way out there. So if you have Orthodox Christianity as expanded theism, then you might be able to say God is a morally sufficient reason, but I'm not obligated to tell you what it is. It might even be ungraspable. And since we haven't seen that reason come about, perhaps, we don't know what it is. But our not having it doesn't mean that it's not there. So he's come right up to the edge of seeing a refutation of the argument from evil, and I want to just take our remaining minutes to go through this. I want you to see how he deals with it. The next paragraph. But does not Rao's admission give theists an easy reply to his argument? It would seem that to their belief that O exists, they need only add certain other religious claims. And if you're not a trained professional, you may not have caught this. I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek. But boy, I'll tell you, that just jumped off the page to me. Circle the word add. What did I teach you about transcendental arguments? Transcendental arguments are not additive, cumulative arguments. And so he's treating expanded theism as, I've got this thesis, and then I add this thesis, and then I have this thesis. But just a moment ago, I told you the way we define our theological terms is not one by one by one, but implicitly everything in the context of everything else the Bible teaches. Which is just a long, fancy way of saying we always present the whole Christian worldview. So it's wrong to conceive of this as a worldview that is like in blocks that have been put together. We are not adding. Our concept of God is, by definition, all of these attributes together. So that's the first thing. He says they need only add certain other religious claims that make the existence of ungraspable goods likely. And then jump down a sentence or two, he says, but since expanded theism, Christianity, entails restricted theism, the probability of the former can be no greater than that of the latter when it was disconfirmed by the existence of this suffering. Yeah, I know, I read that sentence over and over and over again. I'm saying, why does he say expanded theism entails restricted theism? Well, is what I just told you. It's because he sees this as separate components. But on our view, you can't break the components apart. Or as I put in my margin, for us it's a package deal. It's not a blockhouse where, okay, we've got this block. See, if you look at expanded theism as three truths, just to give an example, and you see them as conjoined truths, this and this and this, then it's true that theism entails the one truth as well. That's the way he's handling it. It's like you have component parts all added together, and so I can take one out and say that that is entailed. He's right. Unless I've said every component part is mutually defined by every other part, in which case you can't take just one out and let it stand by itself. So it turns out that restricted theism has the problems that he has said. Expanded theism does not, and expanded theism does not entail restricted theism. Now, at the very end of the paragraph, he says, expanded theism cannot be more probable than restricted theism. Why is that? Rao concludes, there is not much to be gained by retreating to expanded theism. Isn't that an interesting word to use? retreating to expanded theism. Expanded theism is not a retreat from, it's bigger, not smaller, is what I'm getting at. And why is it that there's nothing to be gained by retreating to the restricted version or the expanded version? The next line is crucial. In terms of our example, although H1 prime and K may have the same, and now you circle this, predictive value as H2 and K with respect to E, H1 prime would have no higher probability in the light of E, the evidence, and background knowledge K, then does H1. And there's two things to note here. He's saying that there's no higher probability for expanded theism because it entails restricted theism, and he takes higher probability to mean greater predictive value, 346. The bottom of the page. The question is whether this admission by itself makes the existence of evil less surprising than it is on rival accounts. See, he's dealing with a notion of probability interpreted in light of predictability, and predictability understood as if it's predictable, it's less surprising. But you see, that's not our concept of probability, of what is necessary to offer as a reason for the evil in this world. We're not dealing with predictive value at all, nor are we saying that you can take restricted theism, God exists, outside of the context of all the other defining parts of the Bible that tell us about God. Expanded theism stands or falls on its own. In essence, what Michael Martin is doing is he's telling you what I've taught you for 2 days already. Christianity is a worldview that you present all together, not in little component pieces. Well, this is great because he admits that expanded theism solves the problem of evil. And he says Orthodox Christianity is expanded theism. That's a lot of reading, that section of that book. But if you get it under the microscope, you pay attention, although he's not going to let that affect him. In essence, what he said is what I've been saying for years in my apologetic about the problem of evil. And given that that's a logically possible thing, you can't have any inductive argument one way or another about whether there will be an explanation. And the answer to the problem of evil is this: God is a morally sufficient reason, and he hasn't told us what it is. Or he hasn't always told us what it is. Now somebody can say, well, if you don't tell me what it is, I'm not going to accept that God has such a reason. I say, well, I understand that, because basically you think you stand in judgment over God. On your view, God cannot be considered good unless he passes your test. But you see, within our worldview, that's not acceptable. God is good by definition. God is good by presupposition. My ultimate commitment is to the goodness of God, which is just to say, you cannot say God must pass my test in order to be God. So we've got two different worldviews here, don't we? And one doesn't have any problem with the problem of evil. Well, it does have some. It has a lot of psychological problems. Those of you who have heard my lectures, you know I'm quite willing to admit that it's hard at times to be a Christian. I've had many times when I've cried out, why, God? Why do I hurt like this? Why do I have to go through this trouble? So there are psychological problems with evil. We don't know what the reason is, and so we struggle with the life of faith. But my point is there are no logical, philosophical problems within Christian theology. So Michael Martin has had three basic slams against theism, Christian theism, if you will. And in every case, I think you've noticed there's a parallel to the way in which it's answered. He says, your talk is not meaningful. We say, well, on the basis of our worldview, it is. Because we can give you, within our worldview, ways of talking about God, which, you know, do have empirical. And I say the flower growing in the garden is one of the elements of my worldview and predicted by my worldview and cannot be accounted for apart from my worldview. And yet everyone knows that the flower growing in the garden is meaningful. And to the degree that it resists falsification, All you're telling me is my worldview is presupposed, but then yours is too. So we're even at best, but then as you see, I always go a step further and say, but as a matter of fact, on your worldview, you can't know anything. The second one, having to do with the incoherence of the attributes of God when you try to define them, is only a problem if you define them outside of the language, the biblical worldview. You let philosophers talk about indexicals and descriptions in a passive way that it's brought about by a non-omniscient being, so how could God do that? Well, that's clever. You know, we can all say, and we can all have a little laugh with that. But all said and done, seriously, that's not the way we do theology. So now we have the third problem, that's the problem of evil. But it turns out on the expanded theistic worldview that he refers to, Christianity, God does have a morally sufficient reason for the evil that exists, even though we may not know what it is. And so there's no problem of evil. And I do thank the Lord, because in 60 minutes I did it. All three of the major ones. But I apologize again in one sense. I think you've learned something, but I would love to go page by page through this stuff, because there are mounds and mounds of problems in the way he does this. But the bottom line is, this is no problem for Christian apologetics at all. At first I was inclined to say that's not how I'd understand the fallacy of composition, but put that way, yeah, it's if nothing else, it's analogous to the fallacy in composition. Because what you're saying is, even though the whole can do it, the whole's made up of parts, and if one part can't do it, then the whole can't do it. So, Michael, would you help me pass out some summary sheets here? Before you leave, what I've done here is I've outlined the seminar, and I even outlined the last lecture. Does that give me prophetic ability or what? No, I did it thinking, well, I may have to tell them to scratch out certain lines. But so at our last break, I ran this off because I want you to be able to leave seeing how all this is put together. There really is a method in this bus driver's madness, and I think you can see it as we wind through the summary. I've summarized it in terms of tapes, but they're also the individual sessions of our seminar. And then on the other side, I gave a list of the seminar themes that are illustrated, and when I get done with that, I'll give you my three conclusions. In our first session, I told you that the intensity, the emotional intensity sometimes felt here is warranted. I explained what presuppositionalism is, and I gave an overview of the themes to be illustrated there on the back. And then we talked about the question begging of Michael Martin at his very first sentence when he says there are atheists. In the next session, we talked about his own confession of personal influences and preferences, and noted a number of tendentious failures in his scholarly accuracy. From there, we discussed what he apparently thinks is the burden of proof, given the way he defines atheism, agnosticism, rationalism, and so forth. And then we got into something of a discussion of redemptive transcendental presuppositionalism, just so you'd properly understand this approach to apologetics. In our next session, we went through successively attenuating what Martin claims to show. I found that fascinating myself, and I never finished it because I didn't look at all the introductory sections. But enough got up on the board that you could see that when you finally understand what he's claiming for himself, it doesn't amount to that much. You might want to say, well, why bother with this? And then there's overreaching dogmatism and pervasive epistemic epithets. What's an epistemic epithet? Implausible, irrational, absurd. Pervasively, he throws those terms out. And then as I went on to say, he doesn't have a general and uncontroversial epistemological theory in terms of what he could make sense out of those terms anyway. In our next session, we noted that he is uncognizant of his own biases, that his anti-theistic case rests finally on an intuition claim, and that he departs from paradigms of rationality in order to defend his anti-theism. Now, I know there's much more on the page, but you may notice that if you just followed what we've said through five, we've already thoroughly refuted this fellow. He doesn't make any rational case we should worry about. Tape six, I began to talk about how he doesn't consider the strongest case for theism, and then we looked at isolated elements of things that could be part of a transcendental apologetic: his inadequate rejection of the innate knowledge of God, his inadequate reply to radical skepticism's challenge. We looked at passing aspects of transcendental argumentation, his discussion of paradigms, naturalism, and the argument from consciousness. And then we did take one whole session to respond to an implicitly transcendental argument about the objectivity of moral values. Then today we began with a response to more passing aspects of transcendental argumentation, the argument from teleology, and then the whole issue of explanatory power. So there's been a fairly thorough presentation of transcendental argument that he did not adequately deal with, much less that he ever put it together in its strongest form and refute it. So over and over again, when he says, I've looked at the best arguments, the most representative arguments, therefore I can inductively generalize, no one will ever give an argument, I've refuted that too. As fatuous as it was, even without refutation, I said, well, as a matter of fact, you haven't dealt with the toughest stuff, and when you do get close, you always fail. Then we looked at two elements of religious epistemology. The question is faith, not based on reason. We got into foundationalism, basic beliefs, and so forth. Another one is faith warranted by evidences. And that's where I tried to show you that though I don't think he handles the evidences right, and they should have an effect on him, given his presuppositions, he can always escape them. And all he does in his case against Christianity is illustrate for us over and over again how he's controlled by his conclusion and will not allow any interpretation to stand in the way of it. And then in our last hour, this is the prophetic part of what I did, we dealt with his first major attempted refutation, the factual meaninglessness of religious language, his second, the incoherence in the concept of God, and then his third, the problem of evil. What have we illustrated in these 3 days together? With respect to the practice of apologetics, we see that presuppositions have determinative function in one's reasoning. Secondly, we see that there is a proof of Christian presuppositions by transcendental arguments. And thirdly, that evidential apologetics provides the astute unbeliever with a way of escape. Because you can't let him get away with all that stuff he's doing in this book. You've got to finally call him down. You've got presuppositions. I want a defense of your presuppositions. And then notice critical features of Michael Martin's argumentation. He's not always accurate in his scholarship. He shows strong philosophical prejudice for atheism. Much of what he says rests on vacuous argumentation. Note the repeated pontification, the question begging, the no general theory. He doesn't even consider the strongest case, and then isolated elements of that case were not refuted. Here's my conclusion, and with this we can be done and go to dinner together, hopefully. My conclusion, very simply, is three things. Michael Martin's case is really a long, circular argument that ultimately just begs the question. Two, that he has not rebutted the best argument for God so that his negative theism fails. Three, he has not refuted God's existence so his positive theism fails. Well, even if you have to consider the last rushed part of the course nothing but a program to be filled in, I hope that you found this beneficial and will make you more God-glorifying in the way that you pursue apologetics. Thank you all for coming.